Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM. Talking about things to help you see life a little differently. Maybe more positively, you know, money. Relationships, they're tough, aren't they? Isn't love a tough thing? Mostly what happens in love that is tough is trying to get that other person to be different. There's a, I'm not sure, it may be a Yiddish expression that says after a couple gets married, the woman spends her time trying to get the man to change, and the man spends his time trying to get the woman to stay the same, because she's usually changing and he's usually staying the same. Most of us live with one form of pressure or another, work pressure, money pressure, time pressure, but one of the hardest pressures to handle is the pressure that comes from your mate, your lover, or your family. I'm sure you know what I mean, the pressure that goes between one person and another, the bottom line of which is, I don't like you the way you are. I want you to change. And if you don't, I won't love you. We've talked about this before in other contexts, but I want to spend a program focusing on this issue and only this issue. We recently did a program called Signs of a Troubled Relationship, where we talked about some of the signs of what creeps up. As a result of this, we talked about contempt, and we talked about criticism and stonewalling and defensiveness. Those are the signs that this kind of happens, but today we're going to talk about pressure, emotional pressure that one partner puts on another to get them to change, pressuring people to change. It's often called nagging, but people who do it hate the word. You know, the people who nag hate being called nags. You know the word nag comes from? I imagine it comes from the sound of the horse. You know, the horse, a nag is a horse, yes. And the horse makes that sound. You know, it sounds like a repeated sound. It's a nagging sound, a sound that preys on your brain. Nagging. I guess because the word nagging has been tied to that word housewife, you know. Nagging housewife, a phrase that men use to dismiss women and their needs. But boy, sometimes men are far greater naggers than women. When a man starts feeling frustrated, especially in his work life, he can nag his children and his mates far worse than most women do. Men, as employers, can nag their employees beyond belief, finding fault with them right and left. So I want to use the word nag, nagging, to have nagged, a nagger, naggerosity, nagicity, nagginess. Stay tuned, you mates, you parents, and prospective mates and parents, because there's a very important lesson about life in here today. Let's start off with a definition about love. I like the one that comes from Robert Heinlein's book, Stranger in a Strange Land, in which an alien visitor trying to learn about human emotion asks the question, what is love? And in giving the answer, the answer is, love is the total acceptance of another human being for exactly what they are, with no desire to change them for your own neurotic need. Get that? Big statement. Love is the total acceptance of another human being for exactly what they are, with no desire to change them for your own neurotic need. Everybody quotes the first part, total acceptance. But the real juice is in the second part, with no desire to change them for your own neurotic needs. You see, that's what happens. What happens is you love somebody else and you accept them, But then you want this little change. You may love somebody because they're exciting and vibrant and beautiful, and you're, you know, kind of a stoic, staid, more conservative type. And then you get married and you want them to calm down. So you start nagging them about their loose ends. Or you may be somebody who is who feels at loose ends all your life, and you marry somebody who's a three-piece suitor, you know, and you say because they're conservative and they line up the ducks, and then you begin to criticize them and nag them about the fact that they're so conservative. Little by little, you pick at them and you pick at them and you pick at them. Ah, why do you always have to be so stodgy? Oh, why don't you loosen up? Or why don't you get control of your life? And these little things start to happen. So let's get on to nagging. It's so simple. If you have someone you love, have someone you care about, and then pressure them into doing things they don't want to do, they will hate you. That's nice and simple, isn't it? Well, they'll at least resent you. Isn't that simple? It's a guaranteed formula. Not children. I mean, children will resent you. That's the nature of having a child. Nature of having a child is they will resent you. The way it works is you have a kid, you have this child. The child wants to do something on their own, like they want to set a fire in their room, and because they feel like setting a fire in their room, and you say you can't set fires in their room, and they have all their friends over, and they have matches, and they say, we want to set fires in our room, but we can't do it, and we resent you, Mommy, for doing this, and one day we'll be able to do whatever we want. And this helps a child grow up and get the impetus to grow up and get out of the house. And that's the way it works. That's how children get the motivation to leave the cushion of your soft, lovely homes. So it works. I mean, it's a kind of a resentment, but, you know, on some level, the child leaves and then they love you anyway. But if you have someone who you love and you pressure them into doing something they don't want to do, and they're not your child, they will resent you because you, in a way, make them your child. Did you ever hear somebody nag anybody? It sounds like a parent talking to a child. So when you make somebody into a child, they tend not to like it. They may concede. They may even enjoy the changes they made for a little while, but you live on a kind of a shaky ground. I mean, just for example, you live with someone who is messy, who tends to be sloppy, and you force them, like a parent forces a child to clean up their room, and you yell at them about their messiness. Don't you think they're going to resent you? Yes, you have needs. But when you start, wouldn't you resent someone who's always on your case about something or other? When you start laying your needs on someone else, they may give in, but then they will resent you. So we've got to figure out another way to do this. And resentment sows the seeds for hatred. Do you have any idea how many people hate their mates a good percentage of the time? There's one very good therapist I know, a couples therapist, who says that couples hate each other about 50% of the time. If you look underneath it, about 50% of the time they hate each other. You want to know one of the biggest reasons for that hatred? It's built-up resentment. And built-up resentment over exactly what we're talking about, the pressure to change. Think about it. Think about it with someone you're close to. It could be a husband, a wife, a lover, a partner, or it could be a friend or a family member. Is anybody nagging you to change? Nagging. Nagging. Are they trying to get you to change in a way that you don't want to change? Or are you pressuring someone else into changing? What's the idea here? This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We are going to be taking your calls a little later on this. I'm sure many of you have been involved in this and have something to say about it. What's the idea here? Does the nagger think that if they put enough pressure, the other person will eventually collapse, concede, and the two of you will live happily ever after? Do you think that's the way it works? Do you think if you nag somebody enough, will you put your clothing in the hamper and will you hang up your shoes after you come in the house? Will you wash every dish after you use it? You know, you get enough of it going. And then eventually the person, the idea is if you do it enough, they're eventually going to do it. Is that the idea? Hmm. I'm going to try to get to the bottom of this because there's one clear fact here. If you pressure someone into changing their behaviors, you lose. One way or another, you lose. If they change under your pressure, you lose. Maybe I'm wrong because I've seen one or two relationships that have survived this stuff, but in the long run, they really don't. I do believe that certain couples, especially when it's around addictions, do go and they do make changes. But I'm not talking about addictions where one person is really dysfunctional and the other person wants a change in that dysfunctionality. I'm talking about personal habits where one person just doesn't like what the other person does and they nag them. Talking about pressuring someone into changing the way they are about nagging someone or being nagged, here's two simple facts to be faced here. One is, if you pressure someone into changing, you lose either by resentment or by their leaving you, right? Eventually, they will say to themselves, I am going to find a place where nobody tells me what to do. That goes on in people's minds. The other simple fact is that if you're in a relationship, you can't have it all your way. That's just not a relationship. There is no relationship where you get everything you want. It just doesn't happen. You got two people. It just doesn't happen. You can't have it all your way. You got to have it your way. He or she has got to have some of it their way. Some of their way is not going to be your way. It's got to be okay. So if you're in a relationship, you can do whatever it is to make yourself happy, but by nature of the fact that the other person has a complete right to be themselves, there are certain frustrations you got to deal with. If you can't deal with them, now you have two choices. Either find out what it is that's making you so having such difficulty with the other person's autonomy. You know, maybe you shouldn't be in a relationship. A lot of people shouldn't. Maybe you're better off alone. What's the idea of having a relationship if you just want everything your way? You know, if you want the bed made just so, and you can't stand it any other way, don't be with anybody else. You know, I wonder if they do those things when you get married, you know, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, for who makes the bed which way, for who cleans the dishes, and for accepting the differences between you should be part of that vow. So you got to find out what it is inside you that refuses to let the other person be who they are. I mean, that's the only way you're going to find peace. Or don't get married in the first place. Don't hook up in the first place. Don't try to live with somebody in the first place or leave. Clear and simple, get out of there because the other way is not going to work. And both you and I know that. If your motivation is to change him. Now, I do make one caveat, one exception. If your partner is involved in an addictive behavior that they don't like themselves, like if you're married to somebody who is addicted to drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever it is they're addicted to, and they don't like their own behavior, and they would like to change it, you're helping them with that. Doesn't have to be around nagging, but you're reminding them and working with them. That is a different thing. There you could be demanding change because it might be the only way to get it to work. But if it is not clear pathology, if it's just that their idiosyncrasies irk you, there you got trouble. Let's say you have a wife who goes out to work and every night after work she gets drunk, hangs out with her friends, and comes home every night, parks herself in front of a TV and watches football, and then she falls asleep. What are you supposed to do? Well, by now you have to ask yourself an important question, because life is clearly not happy for you. This wasn't the way you planned it. So this isn't the image of a happy marriage you had in mind. Why does she always got to stop off at the bar, belt down a few, come home, watch the Jet game, fall asleep with the TV on, with a beer in her hand? Why? So what do you do? Nag her about her drinking every night? You think that's going to work? You know it won't, and it doesn't. There's an important question here, and it's the one I ask when people consult me privately. Is this a behavior pattern that's always been there, or is it one that's involved over the course of the relationship? If it's something that was always there, then you need to evaluate whether or not you can live with this and why you were willing to live with it before but are not willing to tolerate it now. I mean, if when you met her in the first place, she used to do this all the time and you used to hang out with her and watch TV and suddenly it bothers you now, you got to find out why that is. But if it doesn't change, you have to ask yourself, maybe the formula doesn't fit. Are you willing to leave if it doesn't change? It's a good question. Ask yourself the question, are you willing to leave if it doesn't change? There are essential questions if the behavior to which you object is one that has been there from the beginning. Because remember, you chose this person, lock, stock, and barrel. You fell in love with a whole person, not just part of a person. So you chose this person and you said, I take you the way you are and not you the way you're going to be. But let's say instead that this is a behavior that emerged since you've been together. Let's say that it wasn't like this at the beginning, and it's that way now. This is Armand DeMille, by the way, in case you just tuned in. We're talking about nagging and the effect of trying to get somebody by change to change by constantly reminding them about how displeased you are with them. But let's say that person changes now, has changed since you've been together or hooked up. Now you have to take a different approach. You've got to ask three basic questions. How did we get here? Can I learn to accept this? Now am I ready to leave? See? But part of the reason people nag is because they don't want to look at their part of what has evolved. Maybe you'll find, if you think about it, that all started around the time you turned off to her sexually. You know, when you were no longer a romantic lover, maybe she didn't go and stop at the bar and come home and turn on the Jet game every Monday night and drink a beer. You know, as soon as you stopped being romantic, she did. You know, maybe it was you were some part of it. Well, a lot of people, when they don't want to look at their own part, they just start nagging the other person. And when you start taking people for granted, that's another thing that happens. So you start taking people for granted and you start assuming they should be serving you, they should be doing for you, they should be cleaning up for you all the time. They should be. That's another one that starts. In other words, if your mate or your child develops some dysfunctional behavior pattern, you are probably some part of it because they're living with you. It takes a bit of soul searching to find the origin, but people who nag don't like to look at themselves. The idea of pointing a finger. Here, try this now. Point a finger somewhere. And you'll see by pointing a finger. Go ahead, point a finger. Point a finger. See? Notice that when you point one finger, there are four fingers pointed back at yourself. Or at least three, right? And that's the idea. The idea is whenever you point a finger, there are at least three fingers pointed back at you. You got to look at those three. Nagging is a way of avoiding looking at yourself. And that's my tip for the day, my friends. That's what I'm trying to show you. It's a good thing because if you learn about that and you say to yourself, well, what is it I'm nagging about? Now, here's an interesting thing about nags, naggers, and naggies. All right? The thing you nag about the most is very interesting. We're going to take your calls a little later. And I am going to ask you to think about that which you nag about. The subject that makes you nag somebody you know or care about. It could be your children. Now you're going to say to me, no, you don't nag. Oh, you do. You do. Do you nag? You got it? Okay, over everybody nags. You nag in some form or other. You can nag anybody, all right? So that's here. I want you to think about that. When we get back later, I'm going to take your calls. I'm going to ask you about your nagging. So it's always good to make the other person wrong, because then you could avoid having to look at yourself. Just make the other person wrong, point out their behavior, then blame and keep blaming the other person until they either change under the pressure or make believe they change, which is this other thing that happens. Nagging results in the other person taking on a position of having changed. They get to look like they've made changes, and they haven't, of course. You know, it's like eat your liver when you were a kid, when you used to hide it under the mashed potatoes. You know, eat that, eat your food. And, you know, you learn to disguise it. You learn to hide it. You learn to feed it to the dog. Or that's what we learned. And when you're away, you know, whenever you're away, this is an interesting thing. If you nag somebody enough, or you keep on somebody's case often enough, when you go away, it's a vacation. I spoke to a woman today who talked about her mother and her father. She said her mother was always there, always reminding them what's proper, what's proper, what's proper. And she remembered when mom went away for 4 days to do something, what a holiday it was. What a holiday it felt like in the house, because they could do what they felt like doing. Do you remember that? Do you remember if one parent or another parent was gone, what it felt like for you when it was like a vacation because your parents weren't around? And they look like they're changing, but only in front of you. I know a man who cheats on his wife. He and she are lean machines, nutritionally conscious, and they basically live a fat-free life. They are very image conscious. He and she have what's considered a decent relationship. But he cheats on his wife. Once a week he goes out and he has a cheeseburger. Yes, that's the way he cheats. Sometimes he tops it off with a scoop of ice cream afterwards. But he doesn't tell her. Why? Because she would get on his case about it. So once a week you'll find him at this restaurant where he sits on his Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock and he eats his cheeseburger. And then he doesn't say a word about it. And if he's particularly defiant, he has a scoop of ice cream. One time I met him at this restaurant, and he's sitting there, and he has this scoop of dreadful ice cream. It must have been something like Breyers or something that they served him. And he only had that once a year or something like that. And he tasted it, of course, and to him it was heaven. It was pure sugar, you know, ice sugar going in his mouth. And he said, oh, man, this is the very best restaurant for ice cream in the entire world. They serve the very, very best ice cream. Of course, he hadn't had ice cream for over a year. It was his treat. It was fantastic. It was marvelous. So he cheats. Never tells her about it. One time, I remember I was with him. And he was having an olive from a salad. He was served a salad. And his wife looked at him, and he was about to eat the olive. And she said, you're going to eat that olive? Do you know how much fat is in that olive? She said to him. He got a little irked. And he said, you know what I'm going to do one day? He said, one day I'm going to buy, you're going to discover my body. And I'm going to have an open bottle of olives that I will have consumed. And that will be my way of getting even with you. Well, he was joking, but you know, I think his cheeseburger once a week is his way of getting even. It just gets tough. I know men and women who are closet smokers. They gave up smoking in their households, but they sneak smokes. What's going on? The closet smokers actually do things to make sure the other person doesn't know about it. They chew gum, they brush their teeth, they hide their smokes. What's going on? I know it's inevitable that someone's going to bring up the case of alcoholism and drug abuse. If you don't deal with it as a partner, you feed the system. So here's an important piece of information about substance abuse and abuse. One of the biggest immediate felt benefits of drugs, especially cocaine, is the relief that you feel from responsibility. You see, I used to be the director of a drug rehab program, and most frequently observed psychological profile of people who overuse drugs is that they had an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. So people who use drugs feel overly responsible. Very often they would feel responsible for their mothers, you know? Very often they would come from a home where their mothers didn't have any money, and they would feel responsible for their mothers and their brothers and their sisters, and they may come out of poverty. So they would be using heroin, and they would be using cocaine, because what it would do is it would take away the sense of responsibility. And you would feel free. Imagine if you felt responsible all the time, and then you felt free of responsibility. Okay, so now what happens? Now this person gets in trouble. They go in, they get in with the police, and they get in some kind of a program. Now they get in a program, and somebody nags them about their drug use. How do you think that works? How do you think nagging works on a drug user? You nag them and you nag them, and you tell them about their responsibility. You got to take care of your mother. You got to take care of your wife. You got to take care of your sister. You're going directly into the thing they hate the most. The reason they're doing the drugs is because they feel overly responsible. By nagging them and telling them how responsible they have to be, you're driving them to the drugs. And there were a lot of drug treatment programs that used to open, and what they would do is they would try to engender guilt. They would try to get you to feel guilty. And they bombed. They couldn't do a thing until the 12-step programs came along. And they said, oh, no, not guilt, brother, not guilt. We'll just share the pain of this thing. But it's not. We're not going to fix it out of guilt, not out of responsibility. There are other ways of dealing with the problem. The most effective was always involves the mates of parents seeing the drug problem not as the other person's problem, but as everybody's problem. Well, I don't want to focus on drug and alcohol usage. I want to focus our attention on the very act of nagging itself. Okay, friends? And when we get back from our break today, we're going to take a break at 1:30. I want to focus on nagging as you know it. Number one, what is it that you nag people about? What is the most frequent thing that you nag people about? What is the nagger in you like? Let's talk about the nagging you. Remember, nagging is anger. Nagging is disdain. Nagging, and I don't mean it judgmentally, is truly disrespectful. It means I don't want you to be who you are. Nagging is a form of hatred. It really is. So, what we want to do, if we can, is to try to get some control over this, so maybe we could find a more effective way of getting the things we want to change to change. We're talking about your experience of this, making people change. The whole idea of trying to make people change. Most of us live with one form of pressure or another in our life. Work pressure, money pressure, time pressure, family pressure. Any kind of pressure that whatever we work with, it comes up in every direction. And, you know, sometimes just to have your mate leaning on your head over and over again, telling you how you have to be different, that's brutal. That's brutal. So you got to put a stop to it. One way or another, you got to find a way to put a stop to it, because it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work. After a while, you either go numb, you go dead on the inside, or you wind up hurting the other person. We don't want that. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue. This is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. My guest in the studio, Dr. Doe Lange, D-O-E-L-A-N-G. And Dr. Doe Lange wrote a book called The New Secrets of Charisma. Charisma, an interesting thing. Doe, welcome to WBAI. I know we are familiar to you, aren't we?
Absolutely, Armand. I've admired you for a long time, and I love what you do on your show and with people, because we're very much in the same ballpark in the way we work with people. I'm an ophthalmologist like you. I believe that everybody has the capacity to be what they might have been.
Well, I tell you, let's talk about charisma itself.
Right.
You think everybody's got the capacity to be charismatic?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I did a questionnaire when I first did the book with 2,000 people, and I asked them, when were you most charismatic? And you know, nobody said never. It was very interesting. So everybody has had the experience, at least for a moment, of feeling that special sense of being charismatic, even though they might deny it the rest of the time.
Well, what does it mean to be charismatic?
Well, I think it means that you feel fully alive and accepted by other people. You're able to connect with people, and you feel your best self.
So charismatic doesn't necessarily mean that kind of magnetism that attracts people. It could just mean that people like you.
Well, that's an interesting question, too.
I think charismatic is, you know, it's I'm a magnet. You know what I mean?
I mean, people, absolutely.
If I'm the magnet, you know, those are the slivers of metal that are going to be attracted to me, or that's the thing that's coming my way. It's coming my way because I am the attractor.
Mm-hmm. And because you have a certain intensity which people respond to.
Is charismatic always intense?
Well, there has to be an energy. There has to be a vitality. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be in the form of manic intensity, certainly not.
I mean, think of Mother Teresa.
Right.
Well, right? Now, charismatic person,
right?
Of
course. Now, what I did in the book is talk about 13 kinds of charisma.
All right. So there we go.
Because somebody asked me, well, how can the Pope have the same charisma as Elvis Presley? And I said, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. So then I decided, well, let's see about the different kinds of charisma. There is performance charisma, like Pavarotti and Barbara Streisand and so forth. Then there is sports charisma, any of the big sports fans. And there is spiritual charisma, like Mother Teresa, who emanates a certain power which is very quiet, but which people feel. And the Dalai Lama certainly has that, too. Then there's money charisma. There, if you're the richest man in the world, of course you're charismatic if people know it. So there are many different – there's cumulative charisma, people we have known all our lives, so they have a certain – appeal for us, like, let's say, Elizabeth Taylor. We've lived our lives with her, alongside of her disasters and happy times and sad times. So that's very – whatever she does is charismatic. Then there's crossover charisma, people like Reagan, who started off in as an actor and became, of course, a politician. And then the final charisma, which is the one that is the most important for everybody, is what I call intrinsic charisma. And for this, you don't need to be born rich. You don't have to be talented. You don't have to be well-connected. You don't have to be anything except have your inner qualities. And I think everybody can remember people that they knew when they were a child who were none of these things. They weren't famous. You smile. I think you have a memory like that. But that person certainly had it. Maybe it's your grandfather or a teacher. So what is that? That's accessible, and that's the inner gifts that we all have.
So do you think it would be a decent thing to have for everybody who's listening? You think they'd all want to be charismatic if they could?
Well, I can't speak for everybody, but what do you think?
But I'm asking you, Doe, because you write the book.
I think people secretly want to be.
You think it's
but there's an ambivalence about taking attention. There's another aspect. I have a psychophysical exercise, which I do with people, which tests how willing they are to take attention. Because, you know, at this point in our lives and our culture, you get high enough in any field and you're in show business. You have to be able to communicate with people. And that's very hard for many people. They may be able to communicate well with 3 people, with 5 people, with 10 people, but 100, 1,000, that's scary. And so it's very, very problematic sometimes. And the interesting thing is, since, as you know, the body holds all the messages we've experienced in our lives, all the good and bad experiences, Whatever our body wants to do is what happens, not what your head wants. So you may think, oh, sure, I want to be charismatic, but inside you really feel shy and you cannot get out there and express
What's the body
yourself.
Exercise that shows you that?
Okay. You start, what I ask people to do, you know, I go into a room with 1,000 people and I say, how many people here know how to hide? And every hand goes up. Because we all learn how to be safe, you know, how to stay away from scary adults and unfriendly big people. But essentially, everybody's a ham. A healthy child who's loved and appreciated is going to say, hey, Mom, watch me. Daddy, look at me. I want to be seen. So we have that aspect in us, which is sometimes crushed for a while, but it's there usually. You know, I often ask people, Armand, do you remember Gulliver's Travels, that marvelous scene when he wakes up in Lilliput and he's completely unable to move? He's completely tied down. He doesn't know why. Little people are swarming all over him. He suddenly realizes that he's tied down by thousands of tiny ropes. And that's a perfect metaphor for inhibitions. So I have an inhibition inventory in the book. What makes you uncomfortable? And it's interesting. Some people who are comfortable speaking or comfortable writing are not comfortable speaking. That's very common.
Well, wait. Now, the idea here, or the very beginning of this, is mm-hmm. is everybody charismatic? How do you find out if you are charismatic or want to be charismatic? And that's your question. Your question is stand up and see what your body tells you. A lot of people feel that if they are charismatic or if they do command attention,
mm-hmm.
if they command attention,
down.
That something will happen. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, those people may choose not to be charismatic,
That's
right?
That's right. Even Marilyn Monroe could choose not to be charismatic. She could walk down the street and not have anybody notice her. So
right,
what
wait.
I'm helping people do is to be able to access it when they want it, but not necessarily have it. Nobody has it all the time, nor would you want to. You don't want to take attention all the time, but you want to be able to when you want to.
Well, I'm not so sure that the charismatic people I know don't have it all the time. They do have it all the time.
Do you think so?
Yeah, everywhere.
Well, a lot of people I know, actors and prominent people, can turn it off if they want not
to be
noticed.
Okay, so now we're talking about a temporary kind of charisma. That attracts. You're saying, yes, you're talking about, well, you know, they're actors, and when they're acting, they're charismatic, but when they're at home, they're not so charismatic. But you see them hanging around with their friends, and they're still the one who draws everybody. Even though
they're
not acting, you know.
They're interacting, yes.
Yeah, but without the acting, without any part of them being unnatural, aren't there some people who are so naturally dynamic?
Yeah.
That they seem to be the center of everything?
Absolutely. But, you know, you said something very interesting, Armand. You said when they're not acting and being unnatural, a lot of people have a false idea of what acting is. Acting is not being unnatural. It's having access to emotions that may not be the current ones of the current situation whenever you want to. And it's actually wonderful training for people because they have the experience of permitting themselves to experience in the body and speaking, what different emotions are, and it's very liberating for that reason. So it's great training. And people who are expressive, this is really the key, people who are expressive have more influence over other people. They've done studies that show that if they're a group of four people, if three are inexpressive and one is expressive, so that's the person with charisma, that person will have more influence than anyone else and can change the mood, the feelings, and the opinions of the others.
Armand DeMille here with Dr. Do Lange. The new Secrets of Charisma is the book, some aspects of it. Okay, so we get the idea. Some people are dynamic, some people aren't dynamic. Everybody you think, and I imagine too, would like to be. But some people have sour grapes. Some people say, I don't want to be dynamic, meaning I don't want to attract people.
Right.
But they say that because maybe they don't believe they can. And another one is there are people who feel that they're afraid. They're afraid to be up there because they're afraid they're going to get shot down. That probably comes from early childhood. So now here comes the next thing. If you've got that, and if you have it, there are a lot of people. If you have the charisma.
All right.
Right? If you have charisma.
Yeah.
Is it always good? I mean, it could be used so badly, can't it?
Ah, that's a very good point. And that's one of the reasons people are afraid of it, because there is such a thing as toxic charisma. My book is not about toxic charisma. It's about positive charisma, intrinsic charisma. But absolutely, charisma is a force like water, like wind, like fire.
I mean, Adolf Hitler was
absolutely
charismatic.
Absolutely. Idi Amin. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we are. There is a fear of people who use their magnetism for evil purposes. Yes.
And then with that fear, right, comes another prejudice against everybody who manifests any
That's
charisma.
True. That's true. Yes. Right. A lot of people are very mistrustful of it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Either they think it's superficial or it's spurious or meretricious in some way. But that isn't really what intrinsic charisma is. What I'm talking about is not political talent, charisma, performance charisma, all those other charisma which have other elements to them. I'm talking about the inner gifts we have which enable us to connect with other people on a positive level, which enlarges our lives and their lives.
Well, I see it as more than connect, though. I think what we're saying is attract. I mean, we're not using...
But then beyond attract, make a relationship.
Okay, but the main, when I think charisma, I'm thinking attracting. You know, I'm thinking that. Then after that, we do other things with it. But if we're going to study charisma, let's study the ability to attract. Now, I think most people listening are gentle souls.
Yes.
I think most people listening are good people. And if we allow them... Right. If they could just say what they believe and say what they feel and share that with other people, it would benefit the whole world.
Absolutely.
So
people are often afraid to show their passion. Don't you think that's true? They're afraid they'll be shot down, afraid they'll be criticized, afraid they'll be laughed at. And yet the irony is that when you are able, let's say you're able to talk personally in public, then you can talk publicly about something personal and everybody will connect with it from the heart level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Armand DeMille here, Dr. Do Lang. We're looking at the new secrets of charisma. We're looking at charisma itself. Certain people seem to be natural leaders. Mm-hmm. Have you found that there is any difference? Because some of the studies that we've done is that your ordinal position or the position in your family, mm-hmm. older child, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Has something to do with it.
All of those positions may or may not have something to do with mm-hmm. it. Have you discovered anything around that?
Well, I think that there certainly is a lot of research about that. There's also very interesting research showing there's a difference in infants and infants' expressiveness. So there are differences in that quarter. And, of course, when infants are more expressive, they elicit more care, which means that there's already a feeling of being responded to, a greater feeling of self-worth. However, that doesn't mean that people can't learn to be emotionally expressive, even if their normal capacity is lower than some others. And learning it is a kind of emotional literacy, which is very important for happiness, for love, for success, and health and well-being.
You know, there's the Toastmaster Club. I guess you know what that is.
I do.
I've seen it's kind of it sounds almost silly, but I've seen people who feel like they could never get outside of themselves join this Toastmaster Club where they learn how to give at least some kind of presentation in front of a group of people. That's all they do. They pay some money to join this group that does it.
I know.
And I've seen people who do it so well, and I've seen them completely change their lives.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I taught at the New School for 18 years, Armand, a course out of which this work grew called Public Speaking for Private People. And it is amazing. Everybody's concerned about communication in some way or another. And there is something very empowering about being able to talk to people, say what you feel, and be heard, even if they don't agree with you. Even if you don't get what you want, it's satisfying to say what you mean and what you feel and feel safe doing it. And you're right, it does transform people. I remember one man who I thought, gee, I don't know what to do with him. I think he's really, he's not very bright, and I don't know if I can help him at all. And then we did the anger exercises. And suddenly, this man changed. And he suddenly was the wittiest man in class, and he said that he was able to dance for the first time in his life. So as Buckminster Fuller said, what's really important is never what seems to be going on. And by developing these psychophysical exercises, which I have in the book, and which have such a profound and immediate effect, this has made a jumpstart possibility for people to go from one state of being that they're familiar with and comfortable with or uncomfortable with, but still familiar with, and resigned to very often, to a new style that's much more expansive and much more playful and interesting. So the psychophysical exercises are kind of the bridge between the state where they've gotten themselves to and the one that they'd like to achieve. And sometimes it happens like that.
What would you do to get somebody to be more charismatic?
Well,
you talked about one exercise.
We have a whole procedure. I mean, you have your protocols, and so does this work, the Charismedia. And one of the first things I ask people to do is, first of all, I ask them what they'd like to accomplish, so they have some idea, because they usually accomplish much more than they intend. But at the beginning, what would you like? Second, are you judgmental on yourself? And then I ask people to keep a little judgmental notebook. What happened that made you judgmental? Was it an internal feeling, thought, or was it external? Something somebody said. And then what did you say to yourself? Oh, you idiot, how can you be so stupid? And that kind of thing that people say all the time. Third thing is, what happened to your body? And most people don't realize something is really happening to their body. Number four, what happened to your breathing? And when you have a little portrait of what your habitual patterns are, and mind-body patterns, it's a beginning to changing that. And then there's certain, for instance, I show people, Armand, how to instantly restore their confidence and self-esteem very simply. I'm sure you've seen kinesiological testing. And if I ask people to hold out their arm and resist when I press down, very strong, and then have a negative thought, don't tell me what it is, and immediately the arm goes down. So then I say, fine, now think of something positive. And the arm's a little stronger, but not as strong as it was at first. Then I give people the magic tongue tap. And what they do is simply tap with the tongue behind the front teeth. That's the alveolar ridge, which sounds like somebody's country house, but it isn't. The alveolar ridge connects with the thymus, which is a little gland that secretes thymosine, which is one of the prime ingredients of our immune system. So when you do that, within microseconds, you test the arm and it's strong again. It's amazing. Then something else. I ask people to think of what they say to themselves.
Wait a minute. Let's back this up a second, though. Okay. You're saying if you tap the inside of your teeth?
No, the inside of your, behind the front teeth, on the gum.
That's what I meant. Okay.
And, you know, actually, every religion has words that do this, like hallelujah.
I know, but if you just did it purposely, and you tap, like right now, like that?
No, you don't have to make a noise.
I know, but I'm doing
it because
people can't see it.
You just tap with your tongue behind your front teeth.
Okay, now everybody could do that
right
now. I'm making noise so I can fill the space.
So let's say they feel uncomfortable.
Now, let's say that you're doing that. Yeah. You're doing that. You're saying that it's triggering a message to the thymus. That is releasing this thing that's going to make your...
Thymosine. Yes, that strengthens the immune system. And actually, in the
and
Chinese...
And strengthens the muscles, too, so much
no,
so that if
to,
you were testing...
To, nothing to do with the muscles.
Well, you're saying if you test kinesthesia...
No, but the kinesiological test tells you what the state of your being is. It's not muscular. It's not about straining your muscles. It's about a feeling of power or not, a feeling of weakness. Now, I also found out when I went to China last year that that place is called the Mudball Palace, and it's the central point of the yin and the yang system. That's where it meets. So it's a very profound secret magic master key, that place. And, you know, when people sing, that's one reason they feel so good. La, 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 la. You're tapping that part. Every religion has words that do it. Hallelujah. Elala ila elalahu. Shalom. Elohim. When you tap there, your whole system is strengthened. So if somebody looks at you sideways or the most important person in the room walks out while you're having a meeting, try that.
Try tapping your inside of your teeth with with your tongue, and that might solve the problem.
Nobody will know you're doing it, and you will feel different. You know, most people try to tough it out. Oh, I'm okay. It doesn't bother me. I don't feel that. It doesn't matter. Their body doesn't believe it. But this changes how they feel.
Interesting stuff. Now, look, you have the charisma. You attract people. The people come to you. You want to communicate with them. You've got to go beyond just your packaging. You know, if you have the magnet, I know they have that nowadays. There are training for the presidents on how to have, or the candidates for how to have charisma, right? The candidates who want to go into office get trained on how to be charismatic, how to move your hands, and not very well at all.
Not very well.
Let me finish this. They're training and they're trying to learn how to do something to attract people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is something, but then how do they back it up when they don't have it? When I watch Robert Dole do his charismatic training responses, you know, when he appears suddenly on a late night show and he's doing his charismatic joking, and then you try to back it up. You look through how thin it is.
That's right.
So you've got to be able to back it up, and that means, I think, you've got to be willing to back it up.
Yes.
You have to be willing to communicate.
Yes.
If you're doing it to sell shoes, that's one thing.
That's right.
And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be charismatic because you want to make more sales, all right, take charisma courses. But if you want to be charismatic to make your life a different kind of thing, giving you more choices, that's a different story.
Exactly. Giving you more choices. Yes. It's like having a bigger vocabulary. If you have more words or more stratagems and more emotional resources, it's not that just you have more things to say. You have not more ways to say them. You have more things to say and more options for behavior, more ability to influence events, and, of course, self-efficacy is very important. If people feel they have some power, they're not just helpless. You know, they say there are three kinds of people: those who make things happen, those to whom things happen, and those who say, "What happened?" So lots of times people feel that they're in that one down position, that they can't have any impact on what goes on. They're the victim of circumstance or their boss or their spouse or their childhood. And that puts them in a very painful, angry, depressed position. And there is a way out, which is authentic. It's not hype. It is not superficial. It has to do with acknowledging oneself, acknowledging the deeper aspects of oneself. And we go into imagery, too, which is very helpful in accessing some of the deeper layers which are not always available on the surface, especially after doing long, deep breathing. You know, breathing is a very important component of learning how to be in your, what I call, your optimum operating state, in your best state. Because lots of people feel, oh, yeah, sometimes I've got it, but I don't know when it's going to hit and I can't control it. So that's not very comfortable. But there are components of the comfort state, of the optimal state, and one of them is breathing rate. So if you just test your breathing, if you're breathing more than 18 breaths a minute, you're probably under very heavy stress. Now, stress is necessary. We have to have stress, fight or flight syndrome and all that. But most of the time, those are not the real options that we're offered, which are the best options, just fight or run away. So we're left with this buildup of hormones and 32 hormones that are released into the system, and no place to go with them. And then shallow chest breathing. So we feel panicked, we feel cut off, and helpless. Now, when we learn the long, deep breathing, and it's a three-stage breathing process. The first one, lying on the floor, you learn how it feels to be totally relaxed. And some people haven't felt that way for years. And then you get back to the state that a child has, which is breathing from the lower belly. When you're breathing that way, you suddenly feel very different, as though you don't have to control things, that breathing will happen naturally, that you're safe in some way. So that's the beginning. People practice that, and then the second stage is like the table model computer. It's miniaturized, and that's sitting in a chair. And even doing this can make a profound change in people's lives. Then the third stage is what I call the microchip, which you can do anytime, anywhere, and it keeps you absolutely intuitively alert and flexible and responsive to what happens. So you, it's like a jazz riff, as you were talking to you. So you're in the right state to join the music.
This is Armand DeMille, the guest, Dr. Do Lang. I want to thank you for being with us, Do. It's been really helpful. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you will hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.